You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
I have no words. I can't even express myself. It's an amazing feeling. I've got mixed emotions. I ran into the crowd earlier and I was crying and I was screaming because it's an emotional feeling. I can't explain how I feel.
He's gone. Jubilation across Zimbabwe as Robert Mugabe resigns after 37 years in power, arguably about 36 years too late, but still. My guests Robert Fox and Mari Bion will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the collapse of coalition talks in Germany. Is a nervous world overreacting? What did Vladimir Putin and Bashar al-Assad discuss in Sochi? And is the foie gras shortage looming over France's Christmas plans really a bad thing? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Robert Fox, defence editor of the Evening Standard, and Mari Bion, UK correspondent for French media. Welcome both. And we will start, obviously, tonight in Zimbabwe, where it is officially the first evening of the post-Robert Mugabe era. The 93-year-old has resigned after 37 years as president of the country he liberated, led, and ruined. His departure comes after a week of uncertainty following his detention by the country's military, during which Mugabe had continued to insist, despite daunting evidence to the contrary, that he was still in charge. It seems likelier than not that he will be succeeded, at least in the short term, by former Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, whose dismissal by Mugabe seems to have been the trigger for the crisis. Mari, first of all, this, we'll talk about the wider implications shortly, but this in itself, Mugabe going, this is good news, isn't it? The people of Zimbabwe are entitled to their celebrations this evening.
Yes, they've been celebrating. I mean, it's been a good week somehow for most of them, wanting a dictator, someone who's been around sticking to the power for almost 40 years, that it was at the end of the tunnel was being seen, and now at last it's been achieved. It wasn't exactly a given, because we remember this a bit of awkward and weird speech that he made, saying that he would still be there when we'd be discussing this and that, so we thought at some point that he would have to be impeached, and indeed the process of impeachment had started, and it's during this impeachment process that the speaker of the parliament read this letter of resignation, apparently voluntary resignation by Robert Mugabe. So the fact that he decided, apparently the president, to resign instead of relying on a very lengthy and complicated process that would have put Zimbabwe on the map again as a country that's a bit complicated to deal with, that would have consequences in terms of the economy as well, this lengthy process. The fact that he decided himself, apparently, to leave the office is something that people apparently have been very happy about. The end goal, him leaving, and him leaving this way by himself at last, is something that people are rejoicing about.
I mean, Robert, there's no real reason, at least on the basis of the last, I don't know, couple of decades, I guess, of Mugabe's rule, why he should be missed at all. But when we look at his career, 37 years in power, and the work he did before that to bring about the liberation of Zimbabwe, does he emerge with much on the credit side of the ledger?
He emerges as a very interesting man, very intelligent, was the arch manoeuvrer, was brilliant in the talks when he came out of the jungle, as it were, from guerrilla activity, I mean, to the negotiations, and took people like Britain's Lord Carrington, I think, by surprise, by his sheer skill and his adeptness.
Because he was at that time that avatar of the new Africa, wasn't he? He was smart,
very
educated,
much a Jesuit debonair. Educated, yeah. etc. But there was always the element of the Machiavelli about him. And this is what we saw in the latter stage of him manoeuvring everything to increasingly autocratic, concentrated personal power. And it's the thing that did for him in the end, because he was quite clearly, from so much of the evidence now, preparing a dynasty for his current wife, Grace, to take over and there to be a succession. And I think that that was the interesting point, where even stalwarts in ZANU-PF, in the movement, and it's still, as far as I can see more or less call a duck by any other name. It's going to be virtually a one-party state, whatever emerges from this. And it was ZANU-PF that really did it, and particularly the element of war veterans who he and Grace had so alienated.
Murray, one odd question or interesting question which now hangs over Zimbabwe, and it's perhaps not the most urgent order of business, but what do you do with Robert Mugabe now? I mean, he's there so far this whole thing, and may it stay that way, has been extraordinarily peaceful, which is unusual when dictators and or authoritarian rules come to an end. It tends to go messily. So far this has not. Should they just quietly punt him out to retirement? Is there anything to be gained for trying to put a 93-year-old of frankly doubtful mental capacities on trial? What do you do with someone like Mugabe at this point?
What they apparently been trying to do is providing a dignified way out. The reason for impeachment, if the process had gone ahead, was the fact that he would have mistreated the constitution, the fact that he would have given the power to Grace, to his wife, and that he was too old. Meaning that there's no, you know, there's so many accusations that they could have put on this bill, and they decided not to do that. They decided to go for 3 points, who are of course not to the honor of the president, but are not too. I mean, it's not too damaging. So clearly, the thinking behind it is to provide him a way to just retire. The question now is: will he retire within the country, or will he decide, or will he have to go abroad? Because he might be seen by some as a father figure, and the way he decided to go might win him some respect, but his wife will never have the respect of most of the population. So she would still be kind of a pariah inside the country. So will he have to leave the country, or can he just retire inside the country? That's the main question. Him being imprisoned or judged or something like that, I don't see it happening. It's still a 93-year-old man that we're talking about.
I mean, I think I'm right in saying that at least one other fallen tyrant, Mengistu, still lives in Harare, does he not? So the Flatshare sitcom writes itself right there. But Robert, if we think that he is likeliest to be succeeded by his former vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, whose own long record of government or involvement in government in Zimbabwe is other than saintly, I think we can say. Should Zimbabwe and the rest of the world be willing to overlook that in the interests of expediency and in the interests of trying to resurrect a country?
Well, stability in trying to resurrect the country, you're absolutely right, and they probably will overlook it for that reason, because it's quite clear that there has been some very skilled negotiation going on with a very stubborn old leader who seems to have indicated at several points that he was going, and then he didn't, and then gave that extraordinary rambling television broadcast just a day or two ago.
It wasn't the greatest of advertisements for his ongoing rule.
Well, exactly so. And, of course, you are quite right to get this country. I mean, it has been ruined, this potentially extremely rich country where there was a very vindictive streak in the way that you had the occupation of the white farms. But I think some of the white farmers didn't do themselves any favours, so I'm not going to make a judgment of Solomon about that. But the crucial element which we have seen behind the scenes is China. China is very present in Zimbabwe. It likes Zimbabwe because it is very important, which is the thing, an obsession now with China for strategic materials and minerals, mm-hmm. and so on. And China, in its own way, had a particular, according to its own rubric, according to its own rules, a way of stabilizing and managing things. And I think that that is what we're going to see. Frankly, I see no constitutional change, or not much. I see it being a one-party state. I still see the army there. But the army, can I just add, has shown extraordinary sophistication about this. And it's for this reason. As you say, it all seemed calm and so on. And this is where one organization really has stood up. And it's the former OAU, but now the African Union. Mm-hmm. Why was the army at pains to say this is not a coup d'etat, this is not a military coup, because it is outlawed by the constitution of the African Union? Yes, we may smile about it, but actually people took notice of this, and they're being very, very careful. And it is very interesting how they are sophisticated And they're very, very experienced. This sort of very interesting constitutional quadrille, the choreography at the moment. I don't think there are going to be big breaks, but I am jolly big breaks with the past. But I'm jolly sure the Chinese are saying, look, we're in it. We're investing in you, and we want return on our investment. We want the country to work again.
Okay, well, let's take a look now at Germany, the politics of which are unusually verging on the downright interesting. The talks, which since September's election have been attempting to forge a new coalition under Chancellor Angela Merkel, have collapsed. The Free Democrats have flounced, leaving Merkel's Christian Democratic Union and putative partners the Greens without a majority. Merkel, who is shorter of options than usual, thanks to the arrival on the Bundestag benches of the xenophobic yahoos of Alternative for Deutschland, is said to prefer a new election to the idea of leading a minority government. It is slightly more complicated than that, of course, Mari. There are various gates that need to be opened and closed before a new election becomes the thing that's likeliest to happen. But first of all, do we fully understand what the Free Democrats are doing and why they're doing it? Because being in government in Germany would be a pretty big prize for them, wouldn't it?
Well, it will be new for them to be in government and to be in government with Angela Merkel. Of course, they're kind of I think that's the first time they're winning seat at the in the Bundestag. So so that will be kind of something big for a new arriving party to be able to go into a coalition. But the problem is, it's not with anyone that they would go into a coalition. They would go to a coalition with the CDU-CSU of Merkel, who's been in power for three coalition time now, and the Greens as well. If Merkel goes with just the Liberal Free Democrats, she won't have a majority. It will be a minority government. So the two options for the FDP is, should we go with Merkel, whatever, and do a minority government, which is going to be a hell of a ride, because on the federal level it's never happened, or should we try and negotiate not just with one senior partner, the CDU-CSU, but also with the Greens, a smaller party? They're basically taken in a sandwich that's not exactly, you know, very good looking for them. But of course, what's hanging over the heads of everyone else in this thing is that if there is another election like Merkel is said to be favoring, that might mean that the other new party who's won for the first time seats at the Bundestag, the AfD, might win more seats, and that would be bad news for all the other parties in the Bundestag, except of course the AfD.
On that subject, Robert, are you surprised that Merkel is so far at least giving every impression of being quite sanguine about the prospect of another election? Might she be calculating or possibly hoping that the AfD eruption is a momentary sort of aberration which the German public will think better of if given another crack at it?
She might be thinking that. Of course, we can't see into her mind, and we've had far too much acreage of print about the personality and how dull and Mutti and the housewife, and frankly it's boring because it doesn't explain her astonishing success. What is so interesting is precisely that, is her grappling. It's not old populism, it's not kind of old street politics which she might have witnessed in Berlin in 68, for example. And as we know, we grew up, she's an Ostie, she grew up in the old East Germany. I think she is finding it very difficult to get to grips with the new populism, not only its manifestations in Germany, but also on its borders, particularly to the east in Poland and Hungary. And listening to Marie and listening to your questions, I was just struck by how this is an imbroglio of tactics with no strategy. There seems to be absolutely no strategic vision. I was baffled. Perhaps it's a symptom of my fast-arriving senility. But I was listening to Martin Schulz this morning, whom we haven't talked about.
Who said that this time they won't go into
government. Won't do this and they won't do that. And I couldn't work out. I mean, it was extremely articulate negativity. So you felt like saying, Mr. Schulz, I was shouting at my radio, so what the hell do you want? You know, because if he thinks by pitching, which he would towards an election, that he is going to gain, and this is the bit, sorry, the office of circumlocution, the point about Merkel I cannot understand
is that she thinks she's going to do better next time round, and if it's only a matter of weeks. And that seems to me to be hubris. And it's actually this whole thing from, you know, we won't go there, but we do have to mention the B word. Brexit all the way through, it's a miasma of tactics, of populist fiddling around, of just messing around with details and not seeing, you know, A plus B is actually, you don't want to go to C and D, but you want to go F, G and whatever. Because this seems to be, just to sum up, that Merkel is catching a very, very nasty European disease of muddle.
On the subject of Brexit, or the spectre of Brexit, which Robert has raised there, Murray, you obviously get to read British newspapers as a European correspondent. What have you made of their coverage? They've been trying to give, or they've been trying, I think, trying to sell their readers on German politics by suggesting that this is good for Brexit for some reason. Does it actually make any difference to anything who is in charge in Germany?
Well, For Brexit, I mean, Brexit, of course, is linked to the EU as a whole, and the couple, the Franco-German couple that Macron and Merkel wanted to reinvigorate, is going to be quite important somehow, symbolically perhaps, for Brexit. If they are seen as the leader of Europe, they will be the one basically doing the calls. And at the moment, what the UK is saying is that many countries are very happy to go to the second phase, which is talking about the future, which is talking about the trade deals, except France and Germany. If Germany wasn't on the same side as France on this particular issue, France would look quite isolated. So, and if someone else than Merkel that wouldn't go along, get along with Macron as much as Merkel would, were one of the two people in this couple, I think the influence of them would be of course diminished. So yes, in the Brexit, the consequence will not be direct, but I think it will be, as a whole, the EU will look a bit less confident somehow, because Merkel is, you know, she's a symbol of the strong and stable politician. Just it's something that's a ridiculous phrase now because of Angela because of Theresa May. But we have to think about the what was said before is, of course, I mean it's evident she's the epitomizing of the strong and stable government. But she thinks, Merkel, that if there's another election, she'll do better. It rings a bell.
It does sound like a story we've heard before, doesn't it?
Yes, this country. I mean, strong and stable. So I can do better? Well, maybe not.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Murray Bion and Robert Fox. Coming up next, what do Vladimir Putin and Bashar al-Assad still find to talk about?
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robert Fox and Murray Bion. Now, there have been many points in the last 6 years or so at which a secret flight to a remote location in Russia seemed an option for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, but most of these scenarios did not involve a return ticket. However, Assad met yesterday with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, in Sochi to discuss the way forward for Syria following what is hopefully the final extirpation of Islamic State as a geographical entity. Putin promised to follow this discussion up by calling other leaders with a stake in Syria, specifically those of Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey, and the United States. On that historical note, I guess first, Murray, how weird does it seem that Bashar al-Assad is still the president of Syria? You'd have got decent odds against that 6 years ago, 2011.
Well, the reason why Assad, part of the reason why Assad is still in place is, of course, Putin. So it does make kind of a sense that the first person he goes to see to talk about long-term peace and to talk about the future of the country is Putin. And of course, what Assad said is that he went there to thank Putin to salvage the integrity of his country. So there's a bit of, kissing ass somewhere, but there's also the wish to talk about, you know, about the future, because the integrity of the country has been preserved partly by Russia, but Russia is still in Syria, and if there's no need for Russia to be in Syria because the Islamic State is defeated, Russia will have to go, otherwise it will be seen as an occupation. So he has to be, it's the same problem. I mean, in whole history, you are being helped because you are in a bit of a pickle by someone, and this someone wants something else in return when things are good again. So Assad is trying to make sure, I guess, what Putin wants out of his generosity for helping to stay in power.
As Mari says, Robert, Bashar al-Assad has been at pains to address Putin by saying, "On behalf of the entire Syrian people, I express my gratitude for what you have done. We will not forget it." Putin is not a man given to acting, I don't think, purely from altruistic motives. What is Russia anticipating by way of reward? It's not like Syria has any oil, for example.
I've got rather a different interpretation of this from your Please. Question and what Marie said. I think he was calling Assad in. And if you read very carefully the text, the Guardian, working from agencies and obviously somebody on the ground, it was quite solemn. Yeah, there was a bit of an embrace, but he didn't go to Damascus. Perhaps that might have been too dangerous. He did it in one of his favourite resorts, mm-hmm. Sochi, and he was giving him orders. It's quite clear that this was going on. We're going to get on with the stabilisation because we don't want this to get worse. And either you do it, we're going to maintain the integrity of the Syrian regime, or somebody else is going to do it. There was, in a lot of the back notes to this, observation from all sides that Putin was not giving a blank cheque, a promissory note, to Assad or his dynasty, that you are here forever. It is a delicate point. Because I'm rather surprised you mentioned Saudi Arabia. No, he's going to talk to Qatar first, which is not the friend of Saudi Arabia.
Indeed,
and,
not.
And Trump about this. And the list was very interesting and important, and some of it to be expected, because today, Putin is talking to Turkey and Iran about this, plus Hezbollah. That is the clue to the whole thing. As we've seen, and this is where the Chinese box gets very, very complicated, more draws come out, because Hezbollah is the target of the very aggressive policy of the young crown prince of Saudi Arabia. It is very interesting how current Saudi propaganda is absolutely aligned with that of Israel in saying the spawn of the devil and all menace to stability across the arc of instability from the Mediterranean and going down to the Red Sea and the Gulf is Hezbollah, because they are the linchpin of Iranian interests. That, Lord Copper, is, as you might say, is something of an exaggeration. Hezbollah, indeed, has proved itself to be an extremely effective fighting unit. It is still relatively small. It does need the patronage and the pay of Iran. It is suffering quite badly because their militia stepped up and it became an effective army, but it's quite a small one of about 10 to 12,000. And the Hezbollah, which is really holding, it's the bit that really works of the Syrian alliance of forces, is exhausted. And I think that this is why in the statements, in the readouts from the agencies of what Putin was saying, there wasn't a sense of panic. It was very firm. We've got the initiative. I've got a window of opportunity, but we must take it now. And that's why what he was doing with the Astana, sorry, I hope I'm not being too complimentary, the circle of talks, which he has done with combatants and interested parties in Kazakhstan, involving Turkey, Iran, and so on. He's saying that will now be the forum for peace negotiations and not the UN-sponsored talks in Geneva. So it's a big diplomatic revolution which is going on at the moment. And what was so interesting about the Sochi talks, and I do stress this from everything I've read, from looking at the body language, this was not triumphalist. We've got away with it so far. The fighting has died down, but you must now go on with the diplomacy in my terms. And Maria's absolutely right. Russia does not want to get its hand caught in the Syrian mangle. It wants minimal presence on the ground there for all kinds of reasons.
OK, well, finally tonight, on an entirely unrelated subject, French folk have been warned to prepare for a Christmas with either less foie gras or less money. Two outbreaks of avian flu in as many years have vastly reduced the number of ducks available to be subjected to the unpleasant process of producing the stuff, with the consequence that prices are expected to spike by as much as a quarter. Fully 86% of French people, it says here, consume foie gras at Christmas. Murray, I do realise that there is a distinction. You are not, in fact, French. You are, in fact, from Monaco. Is the number that high in Monaco, around 86%?
I never did a survey. I wouldn't be able to say. I think, yes, in Monaco, it might be quite true. 86% eat foie gras. Yes, maybe. I don't know again. But I read 86 somewhere. I read 76 as well. I think, you know, there's a difference between having a bit of foie gras at the supermarché because they're giving it away, so you buy it, and having it on the table on Christmas dinner. I'm not sure all the people in France, that many people in France, have the, you know, the morality to eat the foie gras, well, and the money to eat the foie gras.
But this
well.
Is the interesting question, because the French do get beaten up a bit over this. And I struggle with this a bit myself. I mean, I am an unregenerate meat eater and leather wearer. I object to foie gras basically on the grounds that I like ducks, which is not it's not an intellectually or morally supportable argument, but it's...
So you're okay with the geese, are you?
This is what I mean. I'm admitting the weakness of my position. I'm less bothered about geese. They're sort of annoying and obnoxious, but you know, who's got anything...
Aggressive.
I like ducks. I feel we're deviating from the point slightly. Murray, but is there actual argument within France about the moral righteousness of foie gras? Because it is pretty gruesome for the birds involved.
There's always, you'll always see some kind of report before Christmas of the birds being fed with this enormous tube that we put into push down their throat. There's always something. And although, I mean, in London, I saw a protest within, can I say, Mark and Spencer, just in front of the, of this particular shelf. I've never saw that in the equivalent in Monoprix in France or something like that. So maybe we are a bit more, you know, animal conscious in the UK than we are in France. And, you know, it's Christmas time. Just, you know, if we have to think about all the misery happening in the world, we won't be having fun at Christmas. So I do think there's the idea that, you know, foie gras is kind of the, you know, it's a tradition. And most of the people, even if it's 86% of the French people having foie gras, they will be having, you know, a tiny slice of foie gras.
These prices,
killing.
Certainly.
Well, yes, true. The prices are going up, but they're not. They don't feel like Leila. They don't feel like they're, you know, killing a geese or a duck with the little slice of foie gras they will have.
Robert, is foie gras on the menu at Chez Fox on Christmas Day?
From time to time it is. But look, come on, the world is coming to an end. This is like we forget about Oliver Cromwell, but banning Christmas. You know, but you know that I go to Italy.
Where do you sign up for that?
And the vineyards are overrun by cinghiali, by wild boar, and they're protected by the animalisti who are putting up in the general election, and the olive crop is failing and the wine crop is down 50%. Oh, the chicken licking, the sky is falling in. Come on, let's have a bit of fun.
So no one's asked you to be Santa Claus this year, is what?
No.
I mean, just finally then, we've got about 45 seconds left. What does actually constitute, I'll ask you first, Mari, your idea of an actual proper Christmas dinner?
Well, foie gras at the start.
Obviously.
And those who have a bit more conscience can have salmon, if because they are more ugly, it's more okay to eat them.
Apparently.
I don't know. Yes. So, of course, the turkey and chestnut and potato, noirmoutier potatoes. Very, very important. Not any kind of potato.
Okay. And Robert, very briefly?
Almost anything but turkey. But the best one I had was Christmas Eve in Timisoara. Ceausescu had just fallen and we had the most wonderful sturgeon.
That would have been a good Christmas to be in Timisoara, I suspect, not unlike being in Harare this evening, to bring us back to where we came in. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Murray Beyond, Robert Fox, thank you both for joining us. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, research by Guy Lutz and Tom Melville. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's Section D. More on the day's main stories at the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London, of course. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening. We'll